Great. Thanks. It's great to see everybody. I'm very excited to be here today to tell you about my research that I've been doing for the past 3 or 4 years at the Media Lab, where I've been working with Cynthia Brazil on social robots and human-robot interaction. And here at CMU, people know what I mean when I'm saying social robots. What we're talking about is robots that are designed to interact with people. And more these days, we're hearing about visions of social robots that are going to be in exciting domains like healthcare and entertainment and elder care and education. And this is really an opportunity for robots to get out there and make a positive impact in society. So my work is about one problem that all of these social robots are going to encounter in any of these domains, and that's that we're not going to be able to pre-program these robots with everything that they're going to need to know to succeed. So inevitably, these robots are going to have to learn from everyday people sort of on the job once they're out there in these domains. So if we think about social robots learning from people, and we think about what these people, who these people are and what kind of things they're going to be bringing to the table, we can pretty much guarantee that these people are not going to be experts in machine learning. They're probably not going to have any experience with machine learning techniques or systems, but they do bring to the table a lifetime of experience with social learning interactions. So the viewpoint of my research is really that we need to consider and design for what people are bringing to the table and how they're actually going to want to teach these machines in their living room or in their schools or in their nursing homes. And I think this is a really exciting problem, and it's a relatively kind of uncharted territory for machine learning, because a lot of the ways that machine learning systems and algorithms and techniques and the state-of-the-art ways that we get machines to learn new things were not really designed for use by non-experts. So that's what my research is really about, like having these machine learning algorithms and systems be able to interact with non-experts. So this is what I'm calling socially guided machine learning. And it's asking, how can we get algorithms and systems to take better advantage of learning from a human partner, and importantly, learn in the ways that that human partner is going to naturally approach the task of teaching? So I want to quickly go through some of the things that I see as most related in to this work. So in HCI, we've had things like personalization agents and adaptive user interfaces. In machine learning, we have the idea of active learning or learning with queries. In AI and robotics, we have a vast amount of work on in learning by demonstration, programming by example, learning by imitation. And just in the field of reinforcement learning, there is a significant amount of work that has looked at various ways to let a reinforcement learning process be supervised and specific kind of animal training techniques that might be useful in that domain. So the way that I like to characterize how my work is contributing to and complementing all of this work that's been done in looking at how we can get human input to a machine learning system is this. So a lot of times the sort of metaphor or model that we have is that we're asking, what can we get the person to do to make my machine learn better? And so a lot of times this is a really good model, when what you're really trying to do is efficiently and effectively leverage the knowledge of an expert. But now in my work, I want to relax that assumption about the person that's interacting with the machine learning system. I don't want to assume that they're an expert. So now we not only have to ask, what can I get the human to do to help the machine, but also the opposite question. So what can the machine do to really make this process understandable and approachable by non-expert, everyday, average Joe off the street people? So today I want to talk about a few different things. First, I want to talk about an initial study that highlights three kind of topics or themes of this socially guided machine learning problem. And then I want to dig deeper into each of those. And they're going to be guidance, transparency, and asymmetry. So, but first I want to introduce the two research platforms that I've been using over the past 3 or 4 years. One is a robotic platform, Leonardo, and the other is a computer game platform called Sophie's Kitchen. So first, the Leonardo robot. Some people may be familiar with it. This is a 65 degree of freedom robot that is under development or has been under development in the Robotic Life Group at the Media Lab since about 2002. And it is a collaboration with Stan Winston Studios. And the robot was specifically designed for human-robot interaction. So there's an emphasis on expressive communication and gesture. And in all of the work that I'm going to present here on Leonardo, there are both vision and speech inputs, and there's both eye cameras and environmental cameras, and various vision algorithms that run to let Leo do simple object tracking in the environment, in his workspace. Leonardo doesn't move around, so he exists in one location in our lab and has kind of a workspace. So he can do simple object tracking, he can track people in the environment, he can track people's head pose to kind of see where they're looking in the environment. And he can do some simple gesture tracking, like recognizing pointing gestures in the environment. And he uses, we use Sphinx 4 for speech recognition. And the cognitive architecture that all of the work I'm going to talk about is built on top of is historically, it was started with synthetic characters code base from Bruce Blumberg's group at the Media Lab. So this is just a few renditions of Leonardo. This is, on the left is Leonardo cosmetically finished, which is with his fur on, and this is what he looks like in the past few months. We just recently got the fur on. So most of the time that I've been working with Leonardo, he looks more like what you see in the center, so just furry ears, and that's about it. And we're also able to work with Leonardo in simulations. So I've put up a picture of virtual Leo there on the right. So the second platform that I've been using in my research is this computer game called Sophie's Kitchen. And in this game, players are able to teach the robotic agent, this virtual robot Sophie, how to bake a cake. And this is the robot, Sophie. And this is a kitchen that has a shelf and a table. And this is an oven, not a window to Mars. It's a kind of a brick oven, I guess. And so there's various objects that the agent uses to bake the cake, and there's a sequence of things that have to happen, not in any, some things are not in a specific order. So there's one goal of baking the cake, and there's several ways to reach that goal. The state space is observable and discrete, and there's about 10,000 states and 2 to 7 actions per state, so the agent can turn left and right, it can pick up and put down objects, it can use any object in its possession on any object in its current location, and it learns via cue learning. So we built this platform to experiment with human interaction to reinforcement learning. And so the first kind of human interaction is to let people issue rewards to the agent by dragging the mouse up and down. They can create this red or green message that sends a scalar reward between -1 and +1 to the agent. And just a bit of terminology. We're going to call a reward object-specific if it's done on a particular object. And that's just something that I'll talk about in some analysis of the experiments. So here, that would be an object-specific reward to the bowl. OK, so I want to start off with an initial study with this Sophie's Kitchen environment. And as I was saying, this is an environment that we developed specifically to experiment with reinforcement learning and human interaction to reinforcement learning. And this idea of giving people direct control over the reward channel to a reinforcement learner is an idea that has come up in prior work as a good way to add human input to the reinforcement learning process. And so this platform and this experiment was really to kind of question that assumption and say, well, Are people really good at providing the feedback that the agent actually needs? And what do people really, how do people actually want to teach? I mean, this seems like, you know, the hypothesis is that this reward channel is just a really impoverished communication channel between the human and the agent. But what else do people want to say? So what else can we learn about how people are approaching this task? So we had 18 people come into our lab and play the Sophie's Kitchen game on the computer. And these are people from the campus community, mostly. And they did not necessarily have any experience with machine learning or reinforcement learning specifically. So we had people play the game, and the game was logging, making a game log of the whole interaction. And then afterwards, we did an informal interview with people. And we had three main observations from this study. And so I'm going to go through each of those. First, we saw that people they used their reward channel to as a guidance mechanism. So they tried to point out things in the world to the agent. So I'll just give an example of what that meant. So we saw people, when they wanted the agent to do something with the bowl, for example, they would give a lot of positive rewards to the bowl. And the instructions and what they were told was really that, you know, this is a feedback channel. You can send feedback messages. That's how this whole communication channel was described, as feedback. But people assumed that this was something they could do, and you know, the agent understands this in the exact opposite way. The agent now thinks that it's really great that the bowl is empty on the shelf. So that's a sort of miscommunication going on there. So we saw this kind of over people's shoulders and anecdotally, and we wanted to look back in the game logs to see how prevalent this behavior was. So the first piece of evidence, we're going to look at all of the rewards that people gave to specific objects. So we're kind of look at the locations of all of the rewards that people are doing, and we're looking at just the ones that are to objects. And we can think about it, and if a reward to an object was meant in a feedback connotation, then that object should have something to do with the last action. So here we're going to look at all of the object rewards, and for each dot, that represents one of the players in our study. And this is showing the percentage of their object rewards that were about the last object. So 100% would mean that they were always using these rewards in a feedback connotation, and 0% would mean that they never were. So we have a lot of people that are using the reward channel in a way that the agent expects, but a huge number of people that are not. And so a second piece of evidence about this sort of guidance connotation of rewards is we're going to look at just one specific example to see how many people were doing it. We're going to look at the example of giving positive rewards to the bowl sitting empty on the shelf, because this is something that is not part of any reasonable sequences of the task. This is definitely a guidance-oriented reward. And we see that 15 out of 18 people tried to issue guidance rewards to the bowl sitting empty on the shelf. So a large majority of the people in the study assumed that they should be able to direct the attention or point out different objects to the agent with their feedback channel. So the second observation from this initial study is that people actively changed their behavior as they inferred a mental model of how the agent was learning. So we had a lot of people in the interviews afterwards. We kind of asked people if they figured out how the system was working, or how they thought the system was working. We just kind of asked them to describe how they thought it was working. And a lot of people used the same words. A lot of people said that they felt that Sophie was a stage learner. A lot of people said they felt that it was learning in chunks, which is not true. I mean, a Q learning agent updates its Q values after every action, and you know, it's not learning in stages or chunks. But what people were describing is that they're seeing the agent, and you don't really see the result of all of this updating that's been happening until the agent has to come back to some part of the state space that it's been in before. So people would notice a big change in behavior after there was some failure and it had to start over. So the agent would throw the eggs in the oven and then it would have to start over, and people would be, oh, wow, she really knows the beginning of the task now. That's great. And so they reported that that kind of motivated them to give more rewards, and to once they realized that they were really making a difference. And so we see that this actually was a behavior that most everybody was exhibiting, because we can look at the ratio of rewards to actions. So a one-to-one ratio would mean that the person is giving some feedback after every action, so completely supervised. But so we see that over the first three quarters, here we have a bar for each individual person with their ratio. And it gets closer and closer to one. So people are giving more and more rewards as they figure out that they're making a difference. And the third finding from this sort of initial investigation is that about the valence of rewards. And we found that people had a positive bias to their rewards, which we thought was strange. And initially we kind of said, oh, well, that makes sense, because you know, the agent eventually starts performing the task correctly, so the agent must get a lot of positive rewards in the end, and that kind of, you know, throws off the bias of the total bias of the rewards. But then we looked at just the first quarter of every person's training session, and that's what we have pictured here. So for each square is a person, and it's showing the red bar is their total number of negative rewards, and the green bar is their total number of positive rewards. And we can see that the majority of people have a green bar that's significantly higher than the red bar, even in the first quarter of training when the agent is not doing the task correctly at all. So this is interesting, and it really kind of tells us that people have some kind of difference that they're attributing to negative versus positive rewards. So I want to kind of dig deeper into each of these three topics that we've kind of uncovered in this initial study. We've seen that people assume they can guide the agent. We've seen that people change their behavior to try to when they figure out how the agent is working, so we can try to be more transparent. We can have the agent try to be more transparent to help that process. And we see that people have some kind of asymmetric intentions with their feedback channel, with their positive and negative rewards. So first, let's talk about guidance. So we saw people wanted to guide the agent in addition to give feedback, which is pretty intuitive. It makes sense. It's kind of something that you might assume, but it raises an interesting question about human interaction with a machine learning process, and that's, what is the right level of human interaction with a machine learning process? So in thinking about this, I like to think about human interaction with a machine learning process as being on a spectrum from guidance to exploration. And when you do this, it kind of highlights that prior work has often had a constant level of human interaction. So it exists on kind of one point along the spectrum. So like we have things like learning by demonstration, learning by imitation, programming by example. And these are all very guidance-oriented approaches. So the human is very much in control of the process and is and the machine is dependent on the human in order to learn anything. And on the exploration end of the spectrum, we have a lot of reinforcement learning-based approaches, especially those that have been added, things like shaping or clicker training. And those are still very much about the agent going around and learning on its own and not necessarily taking enough advantage of the human in the loop. So in my work, I've been trying to explore this whole spectrum and asking what the right level of human interaction is for different kinds of tasks and algorithms and things. So I want to go through a couple of examples of projects that I've been doing here. I'm going to talk first about a system on Leonardo that has Leo learning it's very much on the guidance end of the spectrum and has Leo learning in a tightly coupled dialogue with a human partner. And then the Sophie game that we did the initial experiment with is very much on the exploration end of the spectrum. So we're going to see how see about adding guidance as well as feedback to that Sophie environment. And I'm not going to have time to talk about it today, but then recent work that I've been doing has really been asking, how can we really have the best of both of these worlds? Because if you think about it, some robot that you're going to want to have in your office, per se, you're really going to want it to be able to learn on its own to some extent, and then also take full advantage of a human partner when they're there. So that's some recent work that is kind of trying to sit somewhere in the middle on the spectrum. So I want to jump in and talk about Leonardo, learning in a social dialogue. And this system is working on top of base behavior of the robot. So we're assuming that the robot has some set of actions. It's able to, it knows about how to act on some objects in its environment. And we're adding the ability for Leonardo to interact with a human partner to learn new tasks based on its known actions and tasks. And it's going to do this by learning a new task, getting a new example from the person, expanding a hypothesis space of possible goal representations of that task, and then working in a tightly coupled interaction that's framed by natural social gestures to whittle away at that hypothesis space and settle on the best representation of the task. So I want to just touch on a couple of the implementation details. The key aspect of the implementation is really that we're assuming that the human is communicating in intentional and goal-oriented ways, and that the job of the system is to really uncover and discover what the overall task goal is that the person really means to communicate. So the representation is hierarchical and goal-oriented, and the robot is acting in a transparent way to solicit the right instruction and feedback from the person as it's going along. So a little bit about the goal representation. So a task goal representation is trying to be a representation of the expectations that have to hold true in order to consider this action or task complete. So here's a little example to show what we're talking about. So if we have some task X, and this is the state of the world before, and this is the state of the world after, the system is going to make this goal representation of the task. It's going to make a goal belief about each object that incurred any change over the task, and the goal belief has the features that it expects for the objects of a particular criteria. So here we have that we're going to expect the color red for objects A and C. So in a state change goal like that, where some aspect of the state changes over a task and you're trying to figure out what the overall goal was, there's some ambiguity about what about that state change was really the goal. Was it the change to this particular object? Was it the change to some class of objects? Was it the change to the whole world state altogether? So the system is going to try to uncover that by expanding some of the possible representations into a hypothesis space. And we're going to do that by starting with the literal interpretation, and expanding some generalizations of that. So in this example, in addition to the literal interpretation, we'll also say, well, maybe we expect the red color for all toy circles. Maybe we expect the red color for all toys. Maybe we expect it for just circles. And so this is reminiscent of a version space kind of thing, where we're starting with the literal representation of what happened, and we're expanding up the lattice of more general representations of what happened. But then when the robot needs to actually execute the task, it has to decide to use one of these, and it's going to do a relative likelihood calculation, where it's going to just look at all the examples of that it's seen of this task and decide which one is most likely. And the only interesting bit of this is that we've decided on for priors that we're going to prefer more specific hypotheses over more general ones. So hypotheses that have more features describing them rather than less. So now we're going to see a demonstration of Leonardo using this learning system to learn in an interaction with a human partner. And
turn all the buttons on.
So he indicates that he doesn't know.
I can teach you to turn the buttons on.
So now that starts the learning.
Press the green button.
And he's assuming that you're leading him through the actions to complete this task that you just named all the buttons on.
Now all the buttons are on.
So that frames the first example, and that sets off this hypothesis expansion. So he had to do one action to make the state change that he saw, and the most specific hypothesis is that he's just going to do that literal version. But that hypothesis isn't any more likely, really, than the others. So he's unconfident, and he's looking back and forth, and he's going to lean forward and perk his ears for feedback after the execution.
Not quite. Press the red button.
And then the feedback leads directly to a refinement and kind of corrects the example.
Now all the buttons are on.
So then that frames the second example, which was actually an execution plus a refinement. And you've seen that, you know, it's not the location that matters or the color that matters, it's the buttonness that matters, and I need to have this light on expectation for all of the button objects in my environment. So that's how you
How do you learn to turn all the buttons on?
So he's still pretty unconfident about the task hypothesis. So he's looking back and forth between the person, and he's being kind of pokey. But so a lot of the interaction is framed by these his eye gaze, looking down at what he's going to do, looking back up at the person. Oh, I stopped it early. So yeah, he finishes the task and he does it correctly.
Feedback he's getting from the person.
When he's
looking at you, he's looking at your face.
He's not getting any feedback in this particular example. We do have that now, that he would be able to actually look up and get feedback as he's going. In that example, the eye gaze is really just a communication device to the person, and then he would be able to get some specific feedback if the person said something. So in that video, he's only getting feedback from the person through speech and their pointing gestures. But now we have things like head pose, and we have some demonstrations of getting facial expressions as well.
The way he or she acts is controlled by what number, what internal state? What internal state decide whether he's a he or she?
The name is Leonardo, so we call him a he. Yeah.
Whether he looks confident or doesn't look confident or look down or not. What are the internal values of deciding that?
So he's got a hypothesis space. He's got a number of task representations that he's thinking could be the right representation of this task. And then he does a Bayesian relative likelihood calculation based on the examples that he's seen. Which hypothesis covers the most examples of what he's seen, basically. And so in those examples, that was after one example and two example, that relative likelihood, that confidence in the particular hypothesis that was chosen isn't very high yet. So that confidence triggers the eye gaze. Yeah.
Why did he learn to only press buttons with your right hand?
So I mentioned that this learning algorithm works on top of his basis set of behaviors. And in that basis that we were working with, he was actually only able to touch buttons with his right hand. And that was only because we only had the glove portion of his hand for his right hand and not his left yet. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you don't need to go back and look at it, but I'm just curious. I mean, the real intent of that question is, why did he learn that, you know, how he was breathing was important, or, you know, which way he was tilting his head was
right.
important. This sort of explosion of possibilities.
Sure. I mean, we constrain the basic set of perceptions that he's going to consider as part of the task representation. So he is considering the state of objects in the world as being what the possible task goals could be about. And the task, we don't let his bodily states or other perceptions that he might have be a part of the task, generally. So that was the Leo learning in social within a social dialogue. So very much on the guidance end of the spectrum, with the human very much in control of the process and kind of leading the process along. So now I want to talk about the exploration end of the spectrum and get back to Sophie's Kitchen and looking at how we can add guidance to this reinforcement learning agent. And so what we're going to do is take the original Q-learning agent and now, instead of prior to action selection, we're going to wait for some guidance, and we're going to now give people an additional channel of communication. So now we're going to let them draw this little yellow square over objects if they want to direct the attention of the agent to these objects. And they still have the feedback channel. So these are just the left and right mouse buttons. Let them do this. And so the way that biases action selection is that the agent, if it gets a guidance message, then the agent is biased to try to do an action that has to do with that object. So just an example of what that kind of looks like. So the agent, the people can give both feedback and they can direct the agent's attention to objects. So we want to look at what kind of effect this has with human subjects. So we did an experiment and had the hypothesis that people were going to be able to use this attention direction to improve the performance of the learning. And so we had 27 people come in and train the Sophie agent, and half of the people had the feedback only, just like the previous case that we saw, and half the people had feedback with this new guidance mechanism. And we see that the people are able to use this mechanism to get the agent to learn significantly better. It's about 50% faster, and 40% fewer failures happen on average between the two. Is the main differences between the two groups. So just to point out again how this is different from prior work. So there has been work that shows theoretically that supervision is going to have these kinds of effects on a reinforcement learning process. And what we're doing is showing that everyday people can be given a high level description of the task and a attention direction signal, and they can get these same kind of theoretical effects. So that shows just a couple of ways that we can incorporate guidance into a learning system along this guidance exploration spectrum. And we can see that the guidance end of the spectrum has certain benefits. The tightly coupled social interaction that we saw with Leonardo and the goal-oriented assumptions about the human partner. And then on the exploration end, any kind of exploration learner has certain benefits where, you know, the person doesn't need to know the task exactly, and the person doesn't even need to be around all of the time for learning to take place. So that's why we're interested in kind of seeing how we can have an agent that is sort of utilizing the best of both of these worlds. And we really want to kind of, in the future, look to having something that can slide kind of dynamically along the spectrum. So that finishes up the guidance topic. Now I want to talk about transparency. And so remember that we saw in that initial study that people were changing their behavior as they developed a mental model of the learner and how it was learning. And this actually looks a lot like human social learning. So with humans, learning is a very social and collaborative process. And what the learner does in that collaboration is actively reveal key aspects of internal state in order to help the teacher maintain a good mental model. So a good teacher will monitor the learner to try to see when the learner is confused versus understanding what's going on. So for example. So then the question becomes, how can we have machines that use transparency to try to improve their own learning environments? So I'm going to talk about some implementations with Sophie and Leonardo that are getting at this question of using transparency devices to express something about the learning process. So with Sophie, we're going to start with the modified agent that has the guidance channel of communication. So now we have this cue learning agent with feedback and guidance. But now we're going to add a gaze behavior. And instead of waiting for guidance, now the agent's going to take and gaze for 1 second at each of the objects that are the sort of highest value, that have to do with the highest valued actions. So this kind of communicates what the agent is thinking about doing and how kind of uncertain the agent is. Just a demonstration of what that is. So now the agent kind of has a neck and can look around at the different objects. And it communicates a level of uncertainty, really. So we want to look at how this affects people's guidance communication. And the hypothesis is that this is going to help people give more informed guidance. So they're going to do a better job of giving guidance when the agent needs it and not giving guidance when the agent doesn't need it. So we had 52 subjects train Sophie, this time in an online version of the game. We were also able to deploy this on the web. In one case, we had feedback and guidance, so no gazing behavior. In the other case, the people had feedback and guidance with the gazing behavior. And we want to look at what this does to people's guidance communication. And we see that it significantly improves the way that the timing of people's guidance communication. So people are able to give more, they're better able to give more guidance when the action selection is uncertain and less guidance when it's certain. And we're calling certain and uncertain are defined by how many actions the agent considers to be equally valued. This is the percentage of people, like percentage of guidance that was given when uncertainty was low. So, and the change between the gaze and the no gaze group. So the gaze behavior reduced the percentage of guidance that was given in the low uncertainty and increased the guidance that was given in the high uncertainty. So it was giving more guidance when it was needed and less guidance when it was not.
So even when the robot was certain, it gazed around?
You mean in the no gaze case?
In the gaze case, if it was confident,
there was still a pause. Okay. Of it didn't gaze around at the different objects. It only gazed around at the objects that it was uncertain at. If it, there was still a pause and it was looking at the object it was going to act on.
Is that given to the subject? In other words, when robot or that graphic does this, then that means uncertainty. Is that
we didn't tell them that.
Is that inferred by the human subject?
Right, that we didn't tell them, oh, by the way, the agent is gazing around to communicate uncertainty. The assumption was that gaze would be a good device to use for that kind of transparency, and this shows that we got the kind of change in guidance communication that we expected from a gaze behavior. But no, people were not told specifically what the gazing was for. Yeah.
So the text says significantly. It's not clear from the low uncertainty that difference is significant. When the uncertainty is high, the agent presumably is going to look at more objects, and if it does it a second at a time, it would seem that the pause is going to be significantly longer than it was in the no-gaze situation.
Sure.
So that in and of itself could tell the difference, because when nothing's happening, people feel more compelled to give feedback.
Right. So in the no-gaze case, there was a significant pause, but it was not variable. So before every action, the agent pauses to wait for guidance. So in the gaze case,
how long is that?
I would have to look back to be sure, but I want to say 2 to 3 seconds.
Okay, so anything over two, if it was uncertain by about more than two objects, then it would, two or three objects, it would wait longer.
Then it would be waiting a little bit longer.
I'm confused here because the biggest contrast is that when they're giving twice as much guidance when the uncertainty is low, which seems like when it's needed the least. Can you explain what's going on?
Between the uncertainty is low and the uncertainty is high? No, I don't know what's going on there exactly. I was looking at uncertainty low and uncertainty high as two sort of different classes, and wanting to look at the behavior within this class between the two, the gaze and no gaze groups. So I don't have much data on what's going on between those two cases.
Well, you may have stumbled over a much bigger contrast than your experimental manipulation.
Yeah, it's possible. So yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to move on to talk about Leonardo. So one thing that it's interesting to think about, the fact that we saw any sort of ability to change people's behavior with the SOFI agent, because this is it's not really a social or expressive or any kind of any of these kind of things that you would think would elicit social responses from people. So the fact that we were able to get any results from this is interesting. And then when we moved to Leonardo, that just opens up a whole new palette of transparency behaviors that we have available to us. So this table kind of goes through some of them that are implemented on Leonardo for social cues in learning experiences. And just to name a few, Leonardo will follow people's pointing gestures with his eye gaze. He will, as we saw when he's performing an uncertain task, he'll glance back and forth between the person and the object. And he'll answer direct questions with head nods and shakes and I don't know gestures. And now that Leonardo has his face on, we're starting to experiment with his kind of range of facial expressions and what that could do to offer another level of transparency to a learning experience. Things like expressing surprise and happiness and sadness during the execution of a task. So we did an experiment with the Leonardo robot and looking at the effects of some of these transparency devices that on a learning process. So what we did was have about 18 people interact with Leo, and they had to label it was this kind of scenario where there were three buttons in front of Leo. They had to label each one with a name and then get Leo to press the button that they labeled on. So we had two kind of conditions. In one condition, Leonardo was only communicating when asked direct kind of questions. In the other case, he was actively trying to communicate his attention and confusion. And what we found was that the version of Leonardo that was proactively communicating his attention and confusion significantly improved the learning interaction. And this was mainly due to speeding up the cases where there was some error in speech or vision detection of the pointing gestures. So what these nonverbal gestures were really able to do was mitigate error and help people see that some error was happening, and they were able to detect it right away. So now I want to move on quickly to the third topic and talk about the asymmetry of the human communication that we saw with the feedback channel. And so one interpretation of that would, of human sort of feedback, positive and negative feedback, would be that positive feedback means what you just did was good, and negative feedback means, well, what you just did was bad, but it's also talking about the future, so that now it's also saying that now you're in this bad state and future action should work to correct that. So I want to talk about a couple of implementations on Sophie and Leonardo that address this idea that negative feedback is about both the past and the future. So with the Leonardo robot, we'll quickly just revisit this idea of refinement. So when he was performing a task that he was unconfident about, he finishes it and then kind of waits for feedback. And if he gets negative feedback, this leads directly to refinement, and the assumption is that you're going to correct that example for him. So
not quite.
So it leads directly into a correction of that example. So this kind of assumption that you're not only just going to say no, but you're going to say no and what next is kind of a guidance-oriented assumption. So that you're kind of assuming that the human partner is there and completely supporting you and is going to provide the rest of that example that you're going to need. So so on the exploration end of responses to negative feedback, we can think about what we want to do with the Sophie agent. And so we saw that there was a positive bias in these rewards that people have. And so initially when we saw this, we had a couple of hypotheses about what people might be doing or what might be contributing to this. And one was that maybe people are treating this agent as kind of a social entity that needs motivation and encouragement as well as instrumental feedback. And then a second hypothesis was that maybe people didn't feel like their negative feedback was really being responded to, and because there's with a learning agent, there's no kind of immediate response to any of the feedback. With a reinforcement learning agent, there's no kind of immediate response to any of the feedback. So people might have felt that, especially in the negative case, that this was the negative feedback wasn't as useful or something. So we explored both of these kind of hypotheses in follow-up work, but I'm only going to talk about the second one, because the undo kind of response. So this is sort of a straight-ahead interpretation of how you could make a reinforcement learning agent more responsive to negative feedback. And we're just going to take the regular Q-learning agent, and now if the reward that's received was significantly negative, it's going to try to undo that action. And in our world, we have some reversible actions and some actions that aren't reversible. So turn left, turn right, pick up, put down. So these are the kinds of things that it's going to be able to undo. Otherwise, it's just going to select another action as it normally would. So now we're going to look at how this works with human subjects. And we had 98 people train the system this time, or train the agent this time. Half the people had this undo behavior, and half the people did not. And we see that the undo behavior of the agent significantly changes the learning session, and it makes The number of failures goes down significantly, about 40%, and the number of actions to the first goal, so it is about 20% less. So the first success of the task is seen a lot faster. I just want to sum up a little bit. We've talked to
this last example. Can you make it better because human subject now has a better advice, or undo, confirm more quickly, or allow to search the space of correct space more rapidly?
Well, it seems like it's probably a little of both, but it definitely visits a significantly smaller version of the state space in order to learn the task, and that happens a lot faster, and it doesn't reach as many failure states. So that's all that we know about it so far.
But you didn't collect any data about the change of the behavior of human.
So we did find that it does this. I don't have the exact numbers on it, but it does balance the feedback, the positive and negative feedback they're giving a little bit more. So it does reduce that positive bias a little bit. Is that what you're asking about? Okay.
What does failure mean exactly? Does it mean that it made a mistake?
Yeah. So failure states would be like throwing the eggs in the oven, some unrecoverable state in the kitchen task, and that would always result in going back to the initial state. So I want to quickly wrap up, and we've talked about a initial study that highlighted some themes of the socially guided machine learning problem. And with guidance, we looked at a couple of systems that are kind of exploring this guidance exploration spectrum. And with transparency, we're looking at how what kinds of transparency devices we could use to really reveal something about the internal state of the agent in the learning process. And then we're looking at this asymmetric interpretation of human feedback. So I want to finish with a little bit of a look to the future, because I feel like this is a kind of very fruitful area of research, this idea of bridging the gap between machine learning and non-expert teachers. And there's a lot of research questions that we can still ask about this, and so future work is definitely going to still be in the same line of asking how we can build learning systems and algorithms that take better advantage of a human partner and the ways that human partner is going to approach the problem of teaching. So I want to just go through a few of the research questions that I'm most excited about. First, with transparency, I think there's a lot of things that we can still ask about how a learning agent can improve its own learning environment by revealing more of its internal state and about what's going on in the learning process. And similarly with guidance, I think there's a lot more to explore with having an agent be able to take advantage of the huge variety of ways that people are going to try to teach it. Specifically, I'm interested in understanding deeper this guidance and exploration spectrum, and thinking about how we can have a system that can slide back and forth on this spectrum and learn on its own, but then also be able to kind of take full advantage of a person's guidance when they're there. And then the idea of an agent learning on its own brings up a lot of interesting questions about motivation. So how can an exploration kind of, or self-learning system be driven to useful and good experiences? What are the kind of drives or motivations that system needs to have in place? And can we make it so that these systems are driven in ways that are similar to animal or human learners? And we talked a little bit about the importance of goal-oriented nature of learning when we're talking about learning from a human partner. I think there's a lot more work to be done here. And specifically, domain transfer is a huge problem in machine learning. I think we can build systems that try to utilize a human partner to work on generalization and domain transfer. And kind of an obvious step for future work is that I've only had the chance to work with a few algorithms so far, so I'd really like to explore a lot more different algorithms in machine learning to see how broad these kind of concepts are. I guess some prime candidates are things like active learning or some semi-supervised kind of learning techniques. And then sort of longer term is the goal of socially guided machine learning would be to synthesize some concrete design principles. So also some sort of social evaluation metrics so that we can start to have some concrete ways of telling people how to build systems that are going to be able to be deployed and learn from everyday people in everyday human environments. And finally, the issue of engagement. So most machine learning systems aren't any fun to teach, and this is a problem because the more data that a machine can get, the more opportunities it's going to have to learn anyway. And you know, one of the best examples of this is actually here at CMU with Von Ahn's work on the Peekaboom and ESP games. So people really love these games. They spend a lot of time with these games, and that creates an incredible environment for the machine learning process to really kind of learn a lot. So having a more principled understanding of this kind of engagement and what makes people stay engaged in the machine learning process is going to be really important for socially guided machine learning. So with that, I'll just take some questions. And
I'm also interested in sort of future problems you're going to tackle. Obviously, you'll have to leave Leonardo behind. Sophie can come with you, but maybe her kitchen needs to be a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
So what do you see as sort of problems you might tackle?
Sure. So I'm interested in both virtual domains and physical social robots. I think that interesting problem domains are, there's some interesting problem domains in education. So looking at robots that can that are helping kids learn some new task or some new some puzzle or some kind of learning task, and having an agent that could work side by side with a child, and having the child and the robot sort of influencing each other's exploration process. So that's an interesting task domain to me. And then virtual worlds are getting more complex. I mean, Sophie is very impoverished in terms of the kinds of things that are available. So taking advantage of all of the insane numbers of people that are out there playing massively multiplayer online games or getting into Second Life and interacting with agents. I mean, we can put virtual agents in there and start to experiment with some of these ideas as well.
So I would like to comment more on your positive bias, reward bias. It looks like our machine algorithms really need both negative and positive rewards, because if we just have positive samples, then with the negative sample, so it will really just learn everything, or like it won't give you a good model. But if you look at babies and small children, they don't need negative examples to learn about placement, to learn about language and other stuff. So my question is, do you think that perhaps the way we approach our machine learning algorithms is wrong? Because we need both negative and positive rewards.
I think it's a good question. This work with reinforcement learning is very, it's starting from the reinforcement learning problem and then backing up and asking, you know, what are some ways that we can change the interface to that? So we're not changing the nature of that algorithm, but I think it's an important problem for robotics in general, and this undo kind of behavior starts to get towards something like that, where you don't really want your robot to have any negative failure experiences. So with robotics, you have to have a pretty positive learning experience, or it has to infer negative examples from the positive examples. I think that's kind of where we are with that.
Some of the conclusions that you draw from your human studies are conditioned to a particular type of algorithm, Bayesian learning or Q-learning. So I was wondering how general these conclusions would be with other type of learning. Do you have any thoughts along these lines? Would we draw the same conclusions?
So I think this is a great question, and I don't think I can make any concrete claims about that until I've experimented with a broader number of algorithms. But I would hope that we can make a sort of synthesis of what are the ways that people approach the task of teaching a machine. That might be conditioned on the kind of nature of the learner. So if the learner is more of a self-learning system, how people kind of approach the task of guiding an exploration versus how people approach the task of giving direct instruction to an agent that's sitting there and waiting to learn. So I would say that maybe we have some differences there. But I think these ideas of attention direction and transparency about the learning process and, you know, the fact that people aren't just giving a scalar reward with their feedback channel. That's actually, you know, they have intentional communication that they are making. So these are things that I think could be pretty general, but still remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. And do you think about if there is a still place for human robot interaction in such a scenario?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and I have some work that I'm doing right now with a different sort of task domain with Sophie, where it's not completely, it's more arbitrary kind of. It's more of a playroom environment, and it's kind of a puzzle task. So a person comes to the table and they don't know exactly how the task is supposed to happen either. So it's really more of a co-learning. The person's learning about how the task is done at the same time as the robot's learning. And I think it's a really interesting problem. I'm still kind of collecting data on that. But my hypothesis is that people will sort of let the robot explore more while they are developing a model of how the task works. And then once they figure out how the task works, then they'll go into this highly supervised mode that we saw with the kitchen task. Yeah.
I'm wondering why this work not more like programming by demonstration, even with old stuff, where in the kitchen you're given a recipe and you execute the recipe and you might screw it up, thus get instruction. But the instruction is not about what is the recipe, it's about how to do the recipe right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much more programming than sort of learning, what do I do first, what do I do second. And you can say, well, kitchens are special. And then I'd say, okay, fixing a bicycle or making a bicycle. Typically there's an instruction book. Now I know people who deliberately ignore instruction books.
Right.
But at least they're there. You can imagine giving them the robot. So how do you see this kind of stuff translate to sort of a very, you know, knowledge-rich, domain-rich interaction?
Yeah. So I mean, that gets more towards the expert teaching the system kind of domain, which is what I was trying to do the opposite of a little bit. So you're talking about a case where somebody has the key, they have the recipe, they have the instruction book, and they want to.
In your example of Sophie's kitchen, it's assumed the user knows how to cook.
Sure, they're given a high level kind of description of what needs to happen.
Right, and so why didn't the robot get that? Maybe from the user, maybe from the whole setup.
Well, Well, I mean, that's the whole problem, is that the user has something they want the robot to do, and they're trying to impart that knowledge to the robot. So that's the whole, you know,
right,
robot in the living room problem.
They can verbally articulate something and input that speech, typing,
programming, out right?
And that's a starting point. And then after that, you would correct and guide.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the assumption of something of this is that people. So I would be more inclined to do something like the learning in a social dialogue, where you're instructing the robot with the actions that it should do. If you know what actions it should do, then you can lead it through the task and it'll learn an example. Oops, I just lost that. So I would be more inclined to do something like that than have the person learn a programming language.
Well, I mean, it can be natural language.
Right, and then you have, well, yeah, so. It's a possibility. Yeah, I think it's an interesting aspect of the guidance question, and it gets to the whole idea that we need to build systems that are going to learn with all of the huge variety of ways that people are going to try to teach them. People are going to try to teach them by saying, no, don't do that, do something else. People are going to try to teach them by saying, you should do exactly this, and people are going to try to teach them in probably 10 other ways. And so we need to kind of think about all of those and think about if there's different tools for all of those, or if there's one framework that the system can kind of figure out what kind of person you are. Are you the kind of person that likes to give me step-by-step instructions, or are you the kind of person that likes to let me explore and correct my mistakes? So that's kind of the way I would approach it.
So what do you think would happen if you had the same type of passage as in Leonardo, but you gave the people only the feedback mechanisms, the guidance mechanisms that Sophie has, so they could point and they could say good or bad?
What do I think would happen? Like, what do I think people would do? Or,
what do you think that would do to the learning process?
Well, it would be, so first of all, it would have to change the base behavior of the robot. The robot would have to do self-motivated actions. And in the examples that I showed with Leonardo here, Leo wasn't doing any self-motivated actions. He was only doing human-directed actions. So first we'd have to change that and have some reason that Leo's going to do anything. And so some motivation to act on objects in his environment, because we're giving him some sort of a priori assumption that changes in the world are what you want to learn about. And then I think that people could probably get similar things to happen. I mean, we could probably get Leo to learn about kind of state changes in the world that the human would want him to learn about.
Do you imagine it would be as effective learning strategy as the current one?
I mean, I think it has different benefits because the current one, you know, that kind of mechanism where the agent isn't doing, or the robot isn't doing any of its own self-motivated action, assumes that the person knows the robot's full range of actions or capabilities. So in the, you know, more self-exploration version, you could bring people in and not tell them really what the robot was capable of doing exactly. The robot could kind of demonstrate its range of capabilities, and that could kind of lead the person to decide, oh, that's interesting, maybe we should get the robot to do that. So it might lead for a little, it might be a little bit more opportunistic rather than premeditated.
But you'd also have the risk of more failure.
Sure, yeah, we would have, yeah, so I wouldn't want to do random exploration completely on the Leonardo robot. I mean, we don't really have too many failure states with the real robot. He's kind of just manipulating objects. He's not going to do anything that's going to break his hand, for instance.
And you turn into one of the grandma things.
Yeah. We don't throw water on him. Yeah.
I'd like to ask a question about the future, but in a way supposed to make it concrete.
I appreciate the need to work with toy domains when you're starting out. The same reason the biologists use fruit flies and bacteria and so forth and yeast. Here's the question. What is one of the first useful tasks that you think will be practical to acquire by socially guided machine learning? And what are some of the things, what are some of the key things you think will break in what you have now in order to get there?
Wow. So I probably have to think about that a little more to give a complete answer. But I think that, at tasks that deal with putting robots into people's homes is a kind of domain where their social learning is going to be necessary because everyone's homes and environments are very different. But then we need things like being able to have very good perceptions of the environment and very good abilities to manipulate objects, because I feel like a lot of the things that people are going to want to get robots to do in their homes is going to be about putting objects over here in the kitchen or over there in the living room and doing kind of object-oriented tasks.
Can you give a concrete example of a specific task?
Sure.
That would be
do my laundry. And everybody has a different kind of, you can't build a robot today, I think, that is going to be a general laundry doer. Because everybody's house is kind of different, everybody's clothes are a little bit different, everybody has different preferences for how they want their things treated or where they want things to be done. So these are things where maybe we could program a robot to be able to manipulate objects in the world, but we're not going to be able to program the high level how you want the robot to manipulate these objects specifically to complete some particular task, like doing the laundry. To human what?
Human subject better. A transparency table which maps the internal state of view to its action. Do you think it can be able to
do that? Yeah, so like learning how to be a bit more transparent learner. Sure, we would have to, I haven't thought about that, but I think we might be able to create a space of transparency devices and try to learn the usefulness of different ones. But I think it might be kind of, I haven't thought about it, but that might be possible. I don't know if we're way over time, yeah.